So, continuing on the theme of one continuous mistake, we've just done a beautiful segue. I guess I would give a new title for today's talk, which is More Mistakes, Please. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, a little bit of a recap. Zen Master Dogen, famous Japanese Zen master, is famous for saying one continuous mistake, you know, lifetime after lifetime, from the original Big Bang to present moment, stuff coming out of my mouth. One continuous mistake. Zen Master Tsung San would say, open mouth, already big mistake. He was also famous for saying, close your mouth, also big mistake. Wanting enlightenment, big mistake. And then I pipe in and say, not wanting enlightenment, another mistake. So with that in, you know, with that in our heritage, you know, we can look at it as a kind of way to relax, actually. Take it easy. What is a mistake other than unintended results? Not what we expected to happen. Isn't that our order of operations? We begin and end with don't know before thinking mind. And oh, for whatever reason, we grow up and, you know, we try to do the right thing, and in spite of ourselves, mayhem ensues. Trouble happens. People get sick. People get hurt in 100,000 different ways. And then we began talking about how to make amends, how to make repairs. Beginning with love and compassion for, you know, one's own temporal being and those who we interact with. I'd like to read a gatha. Gatha is a short poem, a kind of song that's traditional in Buddhist literature. And Robert Aiken had compiled a book, Zen Vows for Daily Life. And these are all gathas. And there was one that I wanted to share with you. He wrote, you know, there are hundreds of these in here, covering every facet of daily life. And in this one, he says, preparing to enter the shower, I vow with all beings to wash off the last residue of thoughts about being pure. One continuous mistake. One continuous mistake. I know there's a story that I've shared with some of you, and I would like to share it again just because it's so pertinent. I was raised in a very unconventional household, and I didn't really realize it until later. I thought everybody's dad went riding grocery carts in the in the food store, shouting out body lyrics and any number of other things. But my mother was an artist, and she did these very fine pen and ink drawings, very detailed. And it would take her a long, long time to do these. And people really loved her work and were very impressed by it. And it always, they would ask her, what happens if you make a mistake? You know, hundreds and hundreds of hours, very fine pen. You can't erase anything. One-shot deal. Her reply, without a moment's hesitation, was, I never make any mistakes. It's my first Zen master. And, you know, I heard that as a child. And you know, I I heard part of it, I didn't hear the whole thing. She would say that and wait for people to, you know, whatever, feel whatever they were going to feel about that. And then she would explain. She'd say, well, whatever happens, I take it as my entrance into unexpected art form, you know, to take it to a place that's new. And that's where the vitality, the creativity of being alive, I mean, to be an artist of a broken world, that's where that comes into play. As a child, I didn't really understand all that little speech. And for years, I had a recurring nightmare of lines that were going the wrong places. And you know, it's funny now, but it really terrified me. It really did. And then I put it together, and I figured it out. Oh, that's from what my mom was telling people. And it's taken a lot of years to really digest and understand what that meant. She was a woman who never apologized. That has its downsides. That has its downsides for sure. But her strength was, and courage was remarkable. And there was something, you know, that I always have learned from. I've been writing this, some of you know I've been writing this book, a memoir of my work in clay, you know, my career in clay. And while, oh, the Eskimos might have, what is it they say, 40 words for snow, potters have about 100 words for mistakes. It's the most, there are so many ways for things to go wrong. Everyone knows about dropping pottery and it breaks. But I could give you a list. I'll give you a bit of a list. It could be broken, cracked, warped, too wet, slumped, dissolved, crazed, too dry, overfired, underfired, exploded, collapsed, melted, fused, pinholed, bloated, scummed, crawled, shivered, blistered, distorted, clay that's too plastic, not plastic enough, uneven, misshapen, wobbled, blown out, cratered, split, peeled, dribbled, and streaked. So another first Zen master in my life has been clay. And, you know, I know that we all have something in our lives that has served that function to throw mistake after mistake at us. And, you know, the teaching point is that we develop, one, a tolerance for error and coming back. You know, a tolerance for mistake, for things not having gone the way we expected, so that we can come back again and again and try again. You know, in one of the conversations I was having this morning, talking about Siddhartha's life growing up, and in this very classical way, he encounters this where things go wrong. There is such a thing as old age, sickness, and death. And we appreciate that even as a child, but it isn't until something really cuts us off at the knees that we finally have to face things did not go as we hoped. There was a mistaken view, a mistaken path, a mistaken dream. Not good, not bad. We just recover and find our direction. There are two things I'd like to talk about specifically. One is fear. One is fear. When we've suffered the results of a mistake, either that we've done to others or that has been done to us, there can be a tremendous amount of fear around that, that can bring us to inaction, to not letting go, but to not, the place of not being afraid to engage. So in our Zen practice, we sit with ourselves long enough in one day. There's no other distracting storyline. Or else we're hearing the same story over and over again until we're finally tired of it and we let it go. I hope we can appreciate the courage that's involved in sitting, seated meditation, so we can just find the courage to confront the fear of not knowing. Not knowing whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, correct or incorrect. From that place, again and again, coming back to not knowing, our courage engendered by that process gives us the opportunity to see, you know, see clearly what it is right now. We don't have to stay on that karmic treadmill. We don't have to stay in the rut because it's familiar. And we can take some relief that, yeah, one continuous mistake. So, okay, I'm just going to try. I'm just going to try. Over and over again, we say there is an order of operation to this trying. If you just do stuff, it's like putting the cart before the horse. It's based on impulse, habit of mind, past karma, and its perpetuation of samsara. Dial it back, first to not knowing, first to hitting the clear button, as we sometimes say. Settling that reactive energy, just seeing clearly. Then, just do it. Go for it. Go for it. We cannot prefigure correct or incorrect, right or wrong. In the interview room, we get to try it out, you know, in a really safe place. And it gives us something, sense of the territory of what's clear action, what's not. But in daily life, we don't have that luxury. Has to happen, has to, you know, you can, sometimes we talk about spiritual materialism or bypassing, spiritual bypassing, where you can just sit and sit and try to be clear and try to be clear and until you're, the idea is, I'll be clear enough to not make any more mistakes. It's not going to happen. I feel really confident saying that. So going along with facing that fear is the generosity that we can give to ourselves in that process. There she goes again. Generosity to others in that respect. There he goes again. There's a story that I would like to just read, if I may. I brought along a little bit of my writing work to do during breaks. And I don't know if that's kosher or not. Probably not. But I want to keep the thread of where I'm working. And so I came across this story that I'd like to read to you. Some of you have heard it from me before. I talked about kintsugi yesterday, that art of repairing broken pottery with gold. There's another Japanese term that I think most people are more familiar with, which is wabi-sabi. Have you? No? Okay, so wabi-sabi is this theater of theory of aesthetics where just what's natural is already inherently beautiful. A rustic, natural sensibility. So in the early part of the 20th century, there's a famous pioneer of the arts and crafts movement in Japan at that time, whose name was Soitsu Yanagi. Among potters, among craftspeople, he's well known. Anyway, he wrote an essay about the nature of beauty. He had always admired the wooden spoons from Korea. There was something about Korean spoon makers that nobody could duplicate them, nobody could find or understand what their secret was to them. But they were known for the spoons were known for their quirky, artistically inventive shapes. Nearly all of these handmade spoons were deformed in some way. But that deformity had a vitality and charm that was admired worldwide. One day, Yanagi decided to make a pilgrimage to that place to learn the secrets of their carving techniques. In Japan, they had skillful woodworkers of their own, of course, but Yanagi bemoaned the perfections of the Japanese wares. The stiffness and symmetry of the finished products never managed to capture the natural beauty for which Korean spoon makers were famous. When the Japanese tried to imitate spontaneous irregularities, the results felt cold and unoriginal. So Yanagi traveled to the spoonmaker's village to see for himself where this magical beauty came from. At the entrance to the village, he saw stacks of pine waiting to be milled. All of it was green, freshly cut, and to his amazement, he watched a woodworker grasp a length of this wood and take it directly to the lathe. Sap sprayed out as he shaped the spoon. Yanagi couldn't help himself, and he called out, "Why are you using green wood? Cracks will appear, you know that. You know, you're supposed to season the wood before you do anything with it." So the turner just turns to him and says, "So?" "But it will leak." "Then we fix it," the turner replied. And he went back to his work. So that was it. That's it. The core of the Koreans' artistry lay in the skillfulness of their repairs. A collaborative process was at play. The material's nature, to warp, to crack when it's green. The artisan's vision, to make a spoon. And the reality of present moment conditions. Green wood meets spoon maker's lathe. Things go haywire, you could say. Precisely because the wood was green, the spoons deformed and twisted naturally into unique and appealing forms. A living, unmistakable quality emanated from these spoons. Something that was perfect in its imperfection. So the title of my book, by the way, is going to be Unmistakable. So there's a kind of theme running through the whole book about mistakes. No mistakes, mistakes, no mistakes. Again, let us cultivate the generosity of this beautiful mistake, so that we can look at it and understand, like, okay, what is it now in reality here? What can we make with this? How can we bring our love to bear on this? Our unique orientations, you know, the way our minds work, all of that. Often I think we get kind of hung up and stuck on the place of breakage, the place where the mistake was made, and we stay there. We kind of stay there and poke at it. That's, you know, if you, going back to clay, if you take this Japanese repair method called kintsugi, where you take the pieces, you see them, you see how they go together, and you put it together in a way that accents those flaws with gold no less, real gold. That's a practice, and this, and here I'm going to quote a kintsugi craftsperson. He says, first essential practice of kintsugi is to set aside our self-defeating emotional conclusions. The stories we've constructed about how impossible it is for us to recover from our devastations, betrayals, and losses. And not only this, but to release the investments we have in keeping our lives broken as a reminder of how we've been unfairly treated, used, or abused. Or the reverse, in the way we have used, abused, or harmed. Even more detrimental, our tendency to cling to misfortunes as a way to prove to ourselves and others that we are damaged goods, not worthy of love, recognition, or success. The master artist can only engage in kintsugi's transformative process if they focus on what is possible, rather than looking back to what's already passed. So sometimes in this broken pottery art form, a craftsperson, not only do they repair it with gold, but they might take a shard from another pot and put it in that one, this other one. So there might be in this ornate, very natural, earthy colored, broken gold encrusted, you know, gold repaired pot, this little square of blue and white, highly decorative porcelain. So this, we can take this practice of one continuous mistake as being an opportunity for play, experimentation. Let's try this. Every time before I have to speak, there is a line that goes in my head that says, oh no, over and over again, oh no. And you know, so then, you know, I show up, I give it a shot. There may be some quirky little piece in it. What is that doing here? This is the art and craft of Zen, the art and craft of one continuous mistake. May we be ever so. May we always have our eye and ear out for making a beautiful repair.